this is a joint work. I think it's slightly different from some of the things we've heard so far. It's preliminary in the sense that, well, I hope the results are not preliminary. I don't think it can come, hopefully wouldn't come along and use the same data and get a different result. But it's preliminary in the sense of, you know, we're still not quite sure where it's all heading. I just want to show you what we've done so far. It's we're kind of like a ragtag group of people. This is Sean and I, a physicist, Mike Spagg is an economist, but really trying to move into political science. Juan Camilo is an engineer, Rojo Jose, economist, and they're here, people in Boulder here. Maria is a lawyer, and we work together under this, what has become what we think of as just kind of looking for patterns in stuff that's violent. And I'll try and put some flesh on that as the talk goes on. One of the things, of course, you know, part of the team being Colombia, was an interesting conflict that was maybe violence, that may be political. And we started working on that, and what we're doing on crime is really kind of tacked on at the end of that. But let me not deal with that for the moment, let me talk about that. You know, from my interest, it seemed that the group in, you know, the when you're looking at trouble with political wars is there's, well, the good thing about political wars now, there's so many people on top of them, the NGOs, the Red Cross, etc. So there are actually quite a lot of different databases that you can kind of check and cross-check to find out when an event happened, like an attack on a given town, you know, thousands of civilians were killed. I wouldn't say murdered or whatever, they were just killed. And you can get pretty good checks on the data. I'm not going to talk about the database, that's kind of an hour discussion on its own. But we're particularly interested in the interaction of these variables, and I'm sure that you know you all are as well. But these are the types of variables that we're going to be exploring. Time and space, also severity. You don't really talk about severity in a burglary, you know, how much was it that you actually took? What was the damage? But of course, in severity in attacks, you know, the damage is the number of people killed. And that's a number, sometimes quite a high number. There are different type of actors, in particular in political, you know, guerrilla groups in Colombia, insurgent groups in Iraq, groups in Afghanistan. How many, who knows how many actors there are? Gangs, you know, some of them act like gangs. There's a history behind the whole thing, and there's also some economics involved. There's some economics involved on the insurgent side that they have to keep going, have to finance themselves. This is the cocaine fields up here, not necessarily in Afghanistan, you know, Afghanistan a drug, it could be general drugs, it could be Colombia. There's also economics on the side of the forces that are trying to eradicate and some insurgency. You know, they've got limited resources. Everyone's got limited resources. And there's some kind of competition going on, perhaps. Where am I heading with this? We're trying to look for some kind of stylized facts, and we're trying to, as the chief Gascon said, peel the onion to try and see not just, you know, is this a stretched exponential or a power law, but is, you know, what kind of models make sense behind these different statistics that we find, and well, they make sense across different scenarios, different platforms. And the sense, the kind of bottom line of what we've come out of this is there are a lot of common patterns. We don't know what that means necessarily. I mean, one could say that actually it doesn't matter what the enemy is, you know, whether they're Maoists or communists or street gangs or whatever. You know, in some sense, the human way in which you do illicit violence may be common in some funny way. And that's one of the things that we think. To get our results, it turns out that we had to use, you know, I come from this, talking about kind of buzzwords, this area of complex systems, which Sid and Ellie come from as well, where these are the types of features that one needs. And we find that these are the types of features, open systems, non-equilibrium, non-local interactions. We need to include these in our models to explain the data. I'm not saying that that is exploration of the data. I'm just saying we need to include them for the models that we've explored. Otherwise, we can't get agreement with what we see. What do we see? Well, let me start off with what we started with, which is looking at Iraq and Colombia, looking at just histograms of, this is a cumulative one, doesn't really matter, the number of people killed, you could also do killed and injured, but this is killed, per event. So X is the number, an event is, you know, a skirmish in Kirkuk or some, you know, one of these things you hear on the news every night. There were 20 people killed here, 50 people killed here, 90 people killed. It's all of those numbers taken and put on a graph. And there's an interesting thing that you see, and you know, I don't want to get into any trouble here, interesting now in data, of course. Interesting thing you see is that it's remarkably straight, this line, which means that you know, it seems to have some kind of power law dependence. Fine, 2.3, so what? You do it for Colombia, and remarkably, it's also a pretty much of a straight line, and the numbers coming out at 2.9. I mean, you wouldn't expect this. You would expect certainly curves to kind of die off, but you certainly wouldn't expect things to necessarily follow such an exact dependence. And, you know, numbers are close, you know, somewhat close. I have to say, we don't just kind of eyeball these straight lines. There's a whole, you know, as you all know, you know, some kind of procedure, maximum likelihood, Kolmogorov-Smirnov statistical tests. I'm not going to go through all that. But then the thing that we did... Right, they were the cumulative.
X-min.
Oh, X-min. It's the estimation. When you do the maximum likelihood, you do it for given X-mins, you then work out using Kolmogorov-Smirnov, which is the closest. Then what we did, it's kind of chronological talk, then what we decided to do, we say, but wait a minute, wars are not like something like crime maybe that are going on and on and on. They kind of are born, they live, and then hopefully they end. What happens over the lifetime of a war? So when we took the war in Colombia, I don't want to go, you know, this is Marxist groups, they're drug mafia, there are paramilitaries who hate the guerrillas, or one of the groups of the guerrillas, but they also hate the army, and the army hates everyone. Well, not hates, you know, I don't mean it like that, but they're, you know, all of these are disordered groups, they're illegal groups, so, you know, the army's job is to keep all of them under control. So this is very complicated, as Sid was talking about, you know, very complicated structure, multi-actor structure. If you take a sliding window through the data, let's take it from Colombia from 1990 up to 2004, you take a sliding window over, I think this was over a year, and you slide this through, and you can't reject the power law, which is interesting, in any of the windows. You might think it's overall power law, but in the bits, you know, you can't tell, and it certainly isn't, you know, certainly isn't power law. It's actually power law within, you know, all of those pass the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. And the exponent that you get out actually looks like it might have some kind of dynamics. And it's rattling around, and it sort of ends up around 2.5. You know, that was 2004. We've got more data. It's still around there. Do it for Iraq. This was a 20-year, 10-year shown here, of war. This was a year of war. It also has some kind of evolution here. The bounds are done by, again, you know, they're bootstrapping methods for estimating the error on the alpha. And you get it rattling in towards 2.5. So, you know, that's what we did, unless we messed up. That's what you'd also get if you took the data. So how do you build a model of that? Well, on the one hand, you could come up with some phenomenological multiplicative model that, you know, produced exponents of 2.5. And this is why I was kind of had, you know, kind of being ironic yesterday about many models produce 2.5. We tried to come up with one that would kind of capture maybe the features of modern insurgency, modern criminal activity. And I make a lot of emphasis on this communication. That first picture, communications which exist in modern insurgencies which didn't necessarily exist before. This was a loan taken off of one small group found in the FARC, some small unit of the FARC, you know, about 20 people. This is what they had on them in terms of communications. You know, laptops, I mean, everything. They had everything on them. You know, and they're also, you know, and you know, they're doing public broadcasts. In fact, they've got broadcasts on their own website. I mean, this whole thing of communications, long-range communication, is quite an important feature, I think. So we tried to come up with a model. So we took the following. Imagine every insurgent group, now whether, I think in this sense, it's whether it's gang members here, or it's insurgents in Iraq, or it's, you know, Maoist, Marxist guerrillas in Colombia, has an attack strength, a total attack strength. Now, I don't mean the number of people in the insurgency. I mean the amount of damage that they can do. So it's the number of people they can kill, say. Now, they are made up of any time of a soup of units. Now, these units can be anywhere. And so I do not mean that this unit has two people in it. I mean that in a typical attack, it could kill two people or 20 people, some multiple of this. And our model is basically that there's this soup going on all the time, and every so often, two of these groups may join. Now, I don't mean they literally, again, this is why I don't like 2D local models. They don't kind of walk around and bump into each other. They're communicating, so they're not even necessarily next to each other. They're coordinating in some way, some small coordination between two groups. Then, occasionally, the forces, the state forces, come along, or the police, if you want to call it that, of course it's the army, or commando units, come along and they come across one of these units. And this unit doesn't break up into five and six, or three and five, they just disperse, they run off, they literally disappear. And that's the model we built. And I don't want to go through all these equations, but that's exactly what it is. It's very similar to the other models of, you know, like forest fires and everything. In its structure, if any, you know, because it's a product kernel here. These are master equations with a product kernel, many of them coupled. But it's very, very different in the sense that it's totally non-local. Everyone can coordinate with everyone if they really wanted to. So these are equations for NS. NS is the number of groups of attack strength 1. So this is the number of groups that could kill one person, and here we've got one of them. Number of groups that could kill two people was one of them. Number of groups that could kill three people, there are two of these, and the number of groups that could kill six, 1. These are the equations for it. This is describing in mathematics just the probability. What's going to happen is these groups, they're more often than not combining, but every so often they get found out and then they disperse. What's built up then disperses. So there's one parameter, which is the probability mu that they combine, one minus mu that they combine and mu that they disperse. Now this can be generalized, you can have mu1, mu2, you don't have to do it every time step. What's remarkably robust out of this model when you solve it in the steady state is that you get the size of the groups, the distribution, the number of groups of attack strength S goes like S to the minus 5 halves. 5 halves is 2.5. I was showing you how there's a tendency for these wars to head towards 2.5. It's a cutoff exponential, just to give you a schematic. This is the plot down here. Of course, this is a vanilla model. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm just saying, you know, this was our starting point. There's only one insurgent group, you know, insurgent force in some sense. But the important part, I think it captures a lot of features. These groups don't have to know each other, talk to each other, anything. You know, occasionally they talk to each other to coordinate, and then they don't coordinate, then they disperse. I mean, it's like this soup of stuff that's going on all the time. You couldn't pin them down. It's very hard to, well, you just wouldn't be able to pin them down. But the interesting thing, they self-organize without any, you know, no mass, you know, nobody making the central control. They're self-organized to produce this power law. Then you can play around. I mean, since then we played around with multiple insurgent groups. How do they interact? All sorts of things. What's interesting, as I said, it's not only is this robust, you can have multiple groups combining and all this sorts of thing. It still gives 2.5. One way you can change it, if you make the more robust groups less likely to break up, then you change the exponent from 2.5 down towards things like, you know, further down 2.5, below less than 2.5. So more robust groups, the more likely you are to have an alpha of less than 2.5. So again, I just leave it at that. That's just something that we've, you know, that's as far as we go. Yeah.
One just question, like the 2.5 that you got, that's based on a prime kernel aggregation.
Yes.
Yeah. How robust is the 2.5 halves?
Like
a constant kernel, for example.
Right. I could give you this wad of stuff that some things change and some things don't. Most of the time it's robust as long as you've got this kind of, like I said, if I've got three groups combining or five groups.
I don't want to do anything that fancy.
Yeah.
Just say, for example, constant kernel aggregation plus your vaporization.
By constant kernel, you want me to base it by some mean field value, one of them, or something like this?
Here you have the rate of aggregation portion of the product of your sizes.
Yeah, right, okay. If, right, and there's a reason for this. This is, Okay, I'm going to get into the details now. The chance of... So the mechanism here is for two groups. What I'm imagining, here are two scenarios that give exactly this model. One is that one member of this group contacts one member of this group. So it's randomly picking out members of the whole population, and therefore that's equivalent to saying that I'm picking proportional to group size. If I don't pick proportional to group size, I start to run into trouble. I don't get a power law.
You don't.
Right. There are some, I mean, I can show you all the nasty details, but...
Yeah, I just had a question going back to the empirical data. You showed them both converging to 2.5.
Yes.
I'm curious, why don't you show data afterwards? I mean, do they stay stable at 2.5?
They do.
Okay.
I just haven't got it up here.
Okay. Because there's some of these... Yeah.
No. I mean, you know... In a way, yeah, but in a way, even if I showed you up to today, so I show you up today, and that's only that amount more. I mean, for Colombia, it's that amount more. And then you can say, yeah, but I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
No. My point is, your claim is that they will stop it.
No, I didn't. I just said this is what they've done so far. That's what they've done so far, right?
Maybe I'm missing something. I thought the 2.5 was supposed to be a special...
All I said was that, no, so this is the data, this is what it does up to now, you know, how can we go about trying to understand it?
Yeah.
Okay? I'm not saying they're sticking there. Let me get on, I'll show you a few more results. I want to give you an idea of rigidity of groups, the amount, so I'm trying to get hold of these microscopic ideas that might explain macroscopic data, that's what I'm trying to get hold of. I'm giving you one idea here, that the more rigid the group is, so even if it was found out, and there's a probability it gets found out, then it doesn't fragment. It's more, you know, it's like stands up for itself and fights. Keep all that in your mind. You'll remember that Bill showed us this curve, these curves which are quite interesting to do with the size of groups in Chicago and, you know, in a certain period many years ago. And Manchuco about the same number of years ago, back in the 30s. They also had slopes around 2.3. I want to pull out a graph that Sid showed and George very kindly sent us yesterday about Long Beach gangs. And we just did a very simple exercise late last night, and we did the following. We said we're going to count the groups that form clusters. These are separate gangs in Long Beach. And I'm going to count the ones, the thick line means they, you know, presumably they don't like each other, according to this graph. And the thin line is that they're cool with each other or whatever. So I'm taking that cool with each other means part of a cluster. Let's just go through this exercise. I think it's kind of interesting. There are 10 gangs that are size 1. There are four gangs that are size 2. In other words, you know, two of them are connected and they're not connected to any others. There's one gang of size 4. It's hard to say, it's yellow. It's the yellow. There's one gang of size 5. And there's one gang of size 6. And this wouldn't get me a pass on any sort of statistics test this. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that you're going to get these kind of gang of gangs, and when I pull up them, remarkably, the first thing is, it's actually, you haven't got many data points, but it's kind of interesting how they fall off on that size. And when you do that, you know, you put them on log plot, and you take the best slope through them, and, you know, on my life, you just want to try and do it if you want. We've got this spreadsheet, you can do it. It's 2.4. It's kind of interesting. Now you can go on, we've done all the wars to which we can get hold of data, and there's a lot of them. And I want to show you roughly that same graph that you have for the gangs. This is wars, this is the US, I'm not very good at history, but US Civil War, Spanish Civil War are interesting. They're kind of really low slopes, they're about 1.8. Which gives you the idea, remember what I said, that if units are kind of rigid, they don't break up easily, you get the distribution of sizes of units is, you know, you can get it down easily to 1.8. By the way, I'm taking a proxy for deaths to be the size of the unit that's causing the deaths. Okay. The others tend to be around 2.5. And if I put them on this line up here, I'll get to this in a minute. Put them on this line up here, it's quite interesting. You know, Northern Ireland, Colombia, I said, look to be moving towards 2.5. I don't know where it's heading. Iraq is moving towards 2.5. It's at 2.5. Who knows where it's heading? Aaron Clausett at the University of New Mexico took the MIPT database of global terrorism events, so it stretches, it's a pretty rich database. And he found a parallel in a separate paper last year, and he found a very strong statistical result of 2.5 for global terrorism. And our gangs are putting us about 2.3. So, of course, I gave you that model of things fragmenting and breaking up. It's one-sided. You know, you say, oh, there are three guerrilla groups in Colombia, and you know, who knows how many in... forget all that for the moment. The vanilla model gives 2.5. If you start to introduce an army that fights them, I mean literally an army, rather than the army being this probability that just breaks them up every so often, you can produce, this is Afghanistan, Iraq, Colombia, Peru. This is data up to now. This is what you can. What you do is you get the bending over. Even the bending over begins to agree with the data. And what's interesting is you can have a microscopic. You have a microscopic handle on what features are going on, what might be going on microscopically that makes the wars different. In a nutshell, one of the parameters in the model is when an army group meets one of these fragmented insurgent groups. What fraction of the insurgent group are killed? So in a battle in Iraq, what fraction of the insurgents that are actually fighting the coalition troops are killed? And the thing is, the higher the fraction, the more it bends over. So at this end, that parameter doesn't have any effect really down here, but it has a lot of effect here. And what this would tell you is that in Afghanistan, they're really good. If I meet 10 insurgents, the coalition forces are pretty good at killing all 10 of them. Here, they're very bad at getting all 10 of them. In fact, they get a very small fraction of them. In Colombia, they get a reasonable fraction. In Peru, Shining Path, they were very bad as well. Here, up here, this cutoff depends on the size of the army that's fighting them. And so in Afghanistan, it doesn't bend much because presumably the coalition forces, there weren't that many of them. The larger the size, the less it bends. So in Afghanistan, presumably there weren't that many of the coalition forces. In Iraq, there's a lot of coalition forces. It doesn't bend. Here, the bending is, you know, then you can go on and interpret it. But, again, I'm just giving you what the numbers say. And these databases are, you know, these come from historians who've collected, you know, diaries of, you know, people in the US Civil War, and they're putting together all the numbers. And this is an enormous amount of work to get hold of these databases. But what does it say? You know, does it match up in any sense to what people say in the news? You know, I'm not in Iraq. I've never been to Iraq. And I don't know what goes on. I just read bits of news. So here are bits of news. And they're kind of interesting. There was a report by General Hayden said that the view of the CIA in Baghdad was that basically, forget the bit about the chaos, that the battlefield was descending into smaller and smaller groups fighting, so this fragmenting idea. You look down here, this is quite remarkable, the communication pre- and post-war, you know, it's gone up by a factor of 10, the number of people that have now got telephones that didn't use to... car owners have gone up, internet subscribers has gone up massively. You know, it's 40 times as many, and they're the legal ones. So that just shows, you know, what kind of communication, coordination could be going on. And then the, you know, kind of anecdotal evidence, this is taken from Global Guerrillas website, which isn't as bad as it sounds. It's, it's a very well-known website, well-respected website here in the US. Which is a quote that, you know, it's become like a gang war. I'm not saying that it is, I'm just saying it's kind of interesting how, you know, we're kind of getting the same, similar messages from all these different corners. That's size of attacks. What about timing? So this is meant to be spatial and it's meant to be time day, as it were. So what we did, we took the number of events per day, very much like Shane was talking about, you know, number of attack robberies or something per day, number of events per day, and we looked at it over a time window. You know, you look at the time series of the Iraq War, and it's, you know, it's very non-stationary, but there are certain, there certainly seems to be kind of epochs in it. So we've checked whether it's epoch dependent or not, but basically 0 to 6 months is a pretty one type of behavior, and it's very close to what you get for a Poisson distribution. The other curve I've shown on here, random war, is something where we jumble, we randomize all the numbers, so the attacks could have happened at any moment in these bins of all the days. But when you get later in the war, up to now, it's very non-Poissonian, and it's non-Poissonian, it's non-random, in other words, in a particular way. There are too many days where there are no attacks. There aren't enough days where there's an average type number of attacks, and there are too many days when there are many attacks. It's bursty. The time series is bursty. And to make sure that we haven't contaminated with a kind of trend in the war, we just randomize within some 100-day bin for this. You know, it's a shown over 500, it didn't make any difference. People, you know, just to show you that we haven't contaminated with some kind of long-term increase in the intensity of the war. Now up here I've also got model. Talk about model output. This is where we start to hopefully put together what we saw about fragmenting agents, and instead of having them randomly attack in order to get the sizes, because when I was doing the distribution of sizes, it doesn't matter when they attack, it's just the size of their attack. Now we want to know when they attack. And so what we, the only model we could find, I'm sure there may be many others out there, the only model we could find is where you have these groups, these insurgent groups, think of them as mini gangs, if you like, who are looking at news about what's happened in the past, or news from the you know, they know what, whether it's been a light day or a heavy day in Iraq in the previous few days, and they're taking decisions, yes/no decisions about whether to attack. And the interesting thing is that here there's one motivation. It's like, and you have to, I mean, this is a stretch, this story, but it's the best that we could come up with. Imagine that we're all insurgents, and we've all got a couple of explosive devices. Now, you don't necessarily, what you really want to do, the only common thing that we all have, we may not know each other, the only common thing is we want to create chaos in some sense, you know, in some loose sense. We want to create disturbance in the place. But the trouble is, if it's a really heavy day when 20 other people are laying explosive devices, I probably don't want to waste my one. You know, I probably want to save that for when other people weren't going to put theirs. So it almost becomes, and this was a model that we took from kind of like market behavior, you're looking for opportunities to let off your one of two devices. And you know, you're going to try and guess from previous days. If you've had five light days, you might think, oh my God, you know, the war's end, I've got to get out there and lay one. And the trouble is, there can be a rush of people that then do that because they're all looking at the same signal. If you build that kind of model, I could again give you the details, you can get very nice fit. Now, I'm only showing you this. We've got all periods of wars for Iraq, for Colombia, for Afghanistan. They all show this tendency from going from random to non-random. You might think it would be the other way around. But wars become less random as they evolve, it seems to us. And they become less random in the same way. Now, how does this all relate to crime? Homicides was, you know, to study homicides, you need some homicides, of course. and so you need a time series of homicides. So we took the homicide data in, now some of you should go to Bogota, it's a beautiful place, but it does have a number of homicides every day, and you know, it's a few. And the interesting thing is that all that data is extremely well taken, it's very well noted, it's the same system for classification of bodies, of death, cause of death, as in the US, it's all very good, it's all very well. So the data is quite good. The interesting thing is that if we do exactly the same exercise we just did, and we do this randomizing within portions of the time series, the black lines are what you would expect from the randomized time series. It's not even fully Poissonian. It's still got some memory because we don't let it You know, we don't randomize over, 20 years. But still, the real data is overrepresented on light days, overrepresented on heavy days, and there aren't enough intermediate days. It's almost like this kind of collective bursty behavior again. There are a couple of trivial results for this. Weekdays have higher means that weekends are higher daily mean than weekdays. There are more deaths at weekends. That's known in other contexts. But what's interesting is that you can take homicides for a given day of the week and they give similar results. So all Thursdays are similar to other Thursdays. All Wednesdays are similar to other Wednesdays. But they're not like Saturdays and Sundays. And I can show you that now. If you take the log of the fraction of days with greater than or equal to x homicides and you plot them out, Monday through Friday, they all fall down onto this, power law looking curve, whereas the Saturday and Sunday look much more kind of log normally, which is more like kind of random behavior. Do this for the conflicts, and it doesn't make a difference whether you're in the weekdays or not. It doesn't really make much difference. Again, we've got Komogorov Smirnov tests on this. Weekdays are very similar. So homicide, there's a pattern in homicides of weeks, Wednesday to Wednesday to Wednesdays, and Thursdays to Thursdays to Thursdays, which is very unlike Sundays to Sundays, the Saturdays to Saturdays. The time between, you can represent homicide like you could any system with crime, in terms of heavy days and light days, and this is what we've done here. I'll show you that again a bit in a minute, but basically the time series are bursty. When you've got bursty time series, you've got something going on that isn't the standard Poisson approximation of independent events with a constant rate. Something gives build-up and then it kind of goes away. Okay. And there's this interesting kind of crossover behavior from the time, this is the waiting time between homicides. The waiting time between homicides. It's random, so if you've had a homicide, you're more likely to have a homicide shortly after. It's sort of like a temporal hotspot. But then there's this period whereby over this, from 5 hours up to 50, they're the ones that if your next event occurs then, it's following a random distribution. But then when you've got the large breaks, again, it's going over to something that is fatter tail than straightforward Poisson. It's not random. There's something very complex going on there. So we want to build towards a prediction machine. Shouldn't do that, but anyway, as I said, don't predict the future, but we're going to try and do it. There's a hope to do it, because if you've got a bursty time series, you might be able to pick up on the runs of zeros or the runs of ones. This is just the barcode of homicides as I gradually raise the bar for the number of homicides I need on a day in order to call it a heavy day. And so as you raise the bar, you see this structure of very much that kind of burstiness appear. This is a function of time along here. So can we capture this in some kind of prediction way? And the way I'm going to do it, I'm not going to go through all the details, but imagine I know that the last two days, I'm going to remove all those means, all those trends, all those seasonalities. I'm not going to just clean them out. I'm just going to say that they're part of the signal. They're the easy bits of the prediction. I can predict that a Saturday will be much more than a Friday, Thursday, and I can tell you what it is. Now I'm going to take those out, and I'm going to look for the fluctuations beyond that. So let's do that, and let's see if we could come up with some kind of prediction. Turns out I haven't tested the prediction in the sense that we've only done it, of course, in sample. We haven't done it into the future. I can't do it. I do it for tomorrow, but then we have to wait for tomorrow to see what happens. Imagine the last 2 days have been light days, even relative to their day. This might be a Wednesday. It's relative to Wednesdays, this is light. And relative to Thursdays, this Wednesday. Relative to Mondays, it was light. Maybe Tuesdays, it was light. What's going to happen on Wednesday? So what we did is we went through and looked at all the conditional probabilities. Given 0, 0, what's the likelihood of having a 1 after it? And you can represent it in these kind of machines here, or these kind of diagrams here. I'm sitting at the moment, on Wednesday, my history is 0, 0. Last 2 days were light. The probability that tomorrow would be a heavy day, and therefore take me from 0, 0 to 0, 0, 1, and move me up here, well, it should be flipping a coin. Well, if there are more heavy days, more light days than heavy days, it will be a biased coin. But here in the black, you can see what those results should be. And the actual time series for homicides is this. If you've had 2 days of light days, then you're more likely to have a light day. you've had 2 days of light days, it's much less likely then to be a heavy day. And you can actually assign probabilities, and these are way outside. You know, this is something like 50,000 randomizations of the numbers here, and not over the whole series. We're not assuming it's stationary at all. So let me move on to now space and space-time, putting them together. We're back to conflict. Of course, the two might be related. That's an interesting thing in itself. They're certainly not double-counted deaths. These are rings showing the red rings. This is a picture of Colombia. The red rings are proportional to the number of deaths, and the ring dies away after it gradually steps down by some fraction every day. So you're seeing, it's almost like a bubbling picture. You get literally a hot spot. A bubble appears proportional to the, you know, what's going on there, and then it gradually kind of dies away. The green are attack numbers, the numbers of attacks. So sometimes you'll see greens without deaths, and sometimes you'll see rings within rings. In other words, revisits to the same place and killing again. This is some of this is the hot spotting of conflict. And it's multi-actor, because we don't just have criminal and police. We have police fighting the guerrillas. The paramilitaries attack sometimes, the guerrillas attack sometimes. This is all noted down, like the Red Cross, the NGOs, they're all sitting there kind of writing it all down, like a kind of sports game almost. And more or less their records agree. So what have we tried to do to analyze this? Well, in Iraq, Colombia, what we're really interested in is there may be many units of guerrillas, but they're moving around, presumably. We want to track. Can we track gangs moving around? So what we do is we take the geography of the country and we work out if in that amount of time between an attack here and attack here, a unit could have walked. Now, this is not just of interest, of course, for a military planning thing. The guerrillas are often taking kidnappees with them. So they're force marching them, moving on to these types. And we want to see what type of trails we end up with. And these are the trails that you find. Now I'm going to run this, and these are real data. Every little blip is an attack. And then the line appears when it's walkable. Okay? And the line is very bright if it was walkable yesterday, and it gets darker as time moves on. Now, you can look at this. I mean, I look at this, and it's like Shane said, you see kind of shapes here. And that's the point. You do kind of see shapes. And these are the types of shapes, and this is why I think it's a kind of interesting twist on the foraging idea. They're not just foraging. I mean, these are possible trails. I don't know that these are the same. These are just the walkable trails. That's all we can tell. There are two types of trails. There are ones that look like they're spreading out into jungle area. It's known that kidnappees are taken along very tortuous paths to get away from, the government-controlled land. But there are also these kind of nesting behaviors, where it's kind of consolidation in a particular area, which we think are really kind of interesting. You can come up with ants, and ants do this type of thing. Yeah, I mean, they probably do. But it's, what we really want to classify now, are there motifs? Are there particular motifs that appear more regularly than random? What are the patterns of behavior? I've only got a couple of minutes, haven't I? That's it. Is it? Or have I got 2 minutes? Have I got 2 minutes? 1 minute? Right. I'm now going to go talk about random. It's going to decay off into randomness because I want to show you the kind of, I tried to now latch it onto things that I didn't know from the criminology field, but I think you all do know. The hot spotting. These are homicides in Bogota, and these are the hot spots. And we were interested, the obvious question was, does it go with population? Well, the interesting thing is, as the hot spot evolves here, the population over years is actually moving away. If you try to follow this, if you try to follow this diagram over time, you'll see that the centre started off really quite populated. Blue is extremely high populated, and then green, and then yellow is very low populated. You'll see over time the actual population, this is census data, begins to move out. But the hotspot's still there. So it's a sort of, you know, no one's living there. Of course, there'll be business down there, but the, you know, the homicide hotspot is, you know, stuck there. I think I'm going to skip over that. We were just doing the K-means type of thing, and these are infection models in the community. I want to get to one particular. Yeah, okay. Here's an interesting problem. So we have models of gangs, like a kind of, instead of them, I should, just instead of gangs kind of, oh, we with a probability, we join each other, we now give them attributes. They've got a kind of vector list of characteristics, and they'll only join with gangs that have got similar vector characteristics, and then they'll might be the enemy of ones that have got the opposite vector, you know, the large hamming distance, but, you know, I won't get into all that. This is just an interesting thing. The crime that, here's the cocaine, so the UM, so the Bulletin of Narcotics, has this as the kind of official picture of cocaine on the left, but this on the right was a fair kind of revelation, not done by us, done by Barry Crane, who's starting to collaborate, who's an ex-director of the US drugs program. Here is a lot of crime, users and dealers on the streets, and up here is the farmer who produces the leaf. And there's this incredible supply chain down here. Of course, I'm really sure you all know. But the interesting thing is it has certain bottlenecks. And the bottlenecks, there are many, many farmers, and they're passing on risk. And unlike the supply chain at Walmart, you don't want the people further along the line necessarily to know who you are. So you often have the same guerrilla groups, different guerrilla groups, using the same farmers and selling. I mean, it's a business where they're getting their money to fight each other from the same farmers who then sell to the same cocaine traffickers, who then pass it down the chain. And the interesting thing is, here's another parallel. It's the price per gram of cocaine at different stages in this process. Like the UN, typically it's upside down. This should be going, you know, ideally you'd read price up here as it goes from the coca leaf up to the street, but here we go coca leaf down to street here. But anyway, what's interesting is that there's, you know, there's this turning point here, which, you know, I like, you know, here's a, Hollywood got it exactly right. When I saw Miami Vice, they were talking about these go-fast boats, and it's exactly what they do. They've diversified the bottleneck of transfer into the US using these boats that refill in fishing boats, and they use submarines. They build their own submarines to pass under bits that are being patrolled. I mean, it's amazing. But anyway, there's this, how can you explain this? The economics of crime. It comes, you know, as you move up here, you've got less and less, presumably, people doing the distributing. And so the price that they're getting is going up for the amount, and the amount that they're transacting is going up, because I'm becoming the wholesaler. And then once I get in, I don't become the wholesaler, I become the distributor. And it gradually works its way down. Why does it follow this shape? What are the risks and costs of all of these? All of these are criminal activities. So, you know, this is crime all the way down. So, you know, here's a kind of large scale, you know, it's not limited to the city of Mesa or Los Angeles or whatever. It's a global thing. And what is going on? Okay, I know I've run over my time. I'm just going to skip to the conclusions. And I'll put that up naughtily as the conclusion, because there's another area of crime that we're looking at where there's a completely global, which is money laundering. Because all of these things that get sold, the money has to be laundered. Can you detect, not now from hotspots in spatial, but hotspots in movements in currencies? Now you're not looking for routine activity, you're looking for non-routine activity in financial transactions to pick up crime. And I won't go through it, but I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But it turns out, remarkably, before the 9/11, these are clusterings which we use to detect abnormal activity in currencies. This is a project with HSBC Bank. Remarkably, 1 week before the 9/11, after 9/11, there were huge movements in the currency markets, as you'd expect. But there were abnormal movements into the Swiss franc from many, many different currencies about 1 week before. You know, we still investigated this to find out what's completely atypical from, you know, 5 years before. Take 5 years data series, it's completely atypical. So we're wondering if these are the types of tools to use clusterings in a different context to look at hotspots in money laundering. Okay, I'm going to leave it like that. Thanks very much for your time.